The New York Post is the tabloid that has become infamous for its sensationalistic headlines, such as 300-pound giant seized in sex attack and headless body found in topless bar. It was at the Post that Susan Mulcahy got her start writing gossip, reporting for and then editing the Post's Page 6 gossip column. Now she edits a similar page at New York Newsday. Mulcahy is not expecting to get the Pulitzer Prize, but she's proud of stories that were broken on her page, like Jerry Hall's pregnancy with her first child by Mick Jagger, and the romance between Sean Penn and Madonna, plus more serious stories, such as Mobil Oil's boycott of the Wall Street Journal. Mulcahy is so protective of her sources, when she kept a diary, she wrote her sources' names in code. She's written a new memoir. It's titled My Lips Are Sealed, Confessions of a Gossip Columnist. I asked her to describe the Page 6 gossip column she used to edit at the New York Post.
Well, it's pretty infamous in the world of gossip because it's got a much different style than traditional gossip columns. It's not, and the column I do for New York Newsday, Inside New York, is similar to Page 6. It's actually, some people refer to it as the Page 6 of Newsday, but it's a bunch of short stories. It's not, and they're written in the third person in a very irreverent tone, and it's not kind of a chatty first person column like the ones that people think of when they think of traditional gossip columns, like Hedda Hopper, Luella Parsons, whatever. And the Page 6 kind of columns focused, helped sort of break open the term celebrity to include all sorts of people that you wouldn't think of when you start to define celebrity. The Lee Iacocca's and the Carl Icahns and, I mean, political and legal figures, not just movie stars. I don't know, sometimes I think it's not such a good thing that the definition of celebrity has been so expanded so wide open, because it gets a little bit ridiculous. You get into your celebrity car mechanic repair people, and I mean, it's just celebrity everythings.
Well, listen, even you found when you got to the Post that you were expected to write about people who were celebrities, but these were people you'd never heard of.
Right. Well, I didn't really, before I started working at the Post, I was sort of my own. I read the New York Times every day. I didn't really read the tabloids. I had never really read a gossip column before. But I mean, I read People magazine. I knew Princess Grace was a celebrity. I knew who the Kennedys were. I knew my favorite movie stars. But they would talk to me, okay, let's get this story. Dick Snyder's doing a big deal with Random House. Da-da-da. I'm like, who's Dick Snyder? You moron, he's the head of Simon & Schuster. Oh, okay, fine, sure. I mean, I had no idea who any of these players are in the Manhattan power game. Like, if you walk into the Four Seasons, which is the big power lunch spot, the grill room anyway, at lunch, I mean, I walked in there, I didn't know who anybody was. Now I walk in there, I still don't know who a lot of them are, but I can point out, you know, I see, always recognize people like Henry Kissinger, but I'll see Cy Newhouse, who's the head of the Condé Nast, the Newhouse publishing fortune, and I recognize him, and I'll recognize Michael Korda, the editor and writer from Simon & Schuster, and Philip Johnson, the architect. And these are all people that they were, I mean, I had no idea who they were.
Given how little you knew about the celebrities you were supposed to be covering, how did you end up writing gossip?
Well, I sort of really did fall into it. I was going to school at Barnard in New York, and I was waitressing for the summer. I thought I was going to be waitressing. This was about 10 years ago, and somebody that I was going to school with worked as a clerk at the New York Post and said, why don't you try out getting a job as a copy girl? And I thought, well, you know, as a waitress, I was very experienced in getting coffee, and that's probably what the main duty of a copy girl was, so I could handle that. And then I'd only been at the Post 3 or 4 weeks, and they needed somebody to be an assistant on Page 6. I mean, I don't think anybody would turn down the opportunity to do a job like that for, say, a couple of months. It would be fun, a kick, something different. I didn't know that 10 years later I would still be doing it, but it's one of those things where every couple of years the whole job definition and my responsibilities changed. You know, I was an assistant for 2 years, and then all of a sudden, boom, I was the reporter, and then I did that for 2 years, and then I was the editor. So my job changed with such regularity that it never got boring, and I stuck with it. So it's been fun.
When you got there, what were the stories you were shown to show you the kind of writing you would be expected to do, or the kind of writing that would be best for this page?
Well, the first person that I worked for, I think, had too bitchy a style. The way she wrote, she always stuck the knife in. She loved to write about people on diets. She'd go, you know, Marlon Brando, who's forever climbing up and down the stairs. She'd go, well, looking a tad pudgy this week, Marlon. Or, you know, Liz Taylor's checked into a fat farm, so, you know, knock off the malted milk balls, Liz. And she would be really nasty to people. And I'd read these items and sort of cringe at some of the leads and the kickers that end them, because they were so so nasty. We did one on Prince. She loved to write about fat people. Prince Renier of Monaco, we did an item on Princess Grace and Renier hiring a new pastry chef. And she ended the item with, he, for one, doesn't need the calories, da-da-da-da. And this there was sort of a nasty tone to a lot of the items, really digging the knife in. And I came to learn that you could have fun with people and be irreverent and not necessarily stab them. You could sort of poke fun at them. And I think that's when these columns work, that's the way they work the best.
How about an example of a leader, a kicker you've come up with that shows how you like to have fun with someone but not really at their expense?
Well, I wrote a story on, there was a big society wedding up here either last month or the month before. Saul Steinberg, the very wealthy financier, his daughter Laura married Jonathan Tisch. I think it was Jonathan, one of the Tisch sons of the Tisch CBS, that family fortune. Although actually, it was the son of Preston Robert Tisch, the former Postmaster General. But anyway, they had this huge wedding that was the most expensive, most lavish, most ostentatious thing Manhattan's seen in a long time. They spent an estimated $1 million just on the flowers, and that I've heard is an underestimate. So I led off the story with something like, because they spent $9 a piece on these special white tulips. So I led off the story with, in our neighborhood, you can get an entire bunch of tulips in all different colors for only $3 or $4 at the Korean fruit stands. Stupidly, we forgot to tell Mrs. Steinberg this, and she went and ordered the special white ones for $9 a piece. And then we went into a whole description of how much the flowers cost and the rather deplorable fact they were thrown out the next day rather than being sent to a hospital or some sort of an orphanage where they would have cheered up somebody's day. But anyway, I mean, you can do it with sort of going, gee whiz, can you believe this is happening, and make people laugh in a way that's not going to hurt them.
Now, how did you find out how much the flowers cost?
I have my sources.
Uh-huh.
No, it was really, that wedding was unbelievable. I think that was probably the last blast of the Nouvelle Society, Reagan overspending. I mean, I can't believe it. Although Donald Trump keeps coming up with new ways to spend more money in ways that people never thought possible. But I hope it's an end to this era. It's really sort of revolting. It's like these people stumble out of their parties across the homeless, while they're... Anyway.
Well, let me reintroduce you. My guest is Susan Mulcahy, and she's written a new book titled My Lips Are Sealed, Confessions of a Gossip Columnist. She used to edit the Page 6 gossip column of the New York Post and now edits the Inside New York gossip column, or People Page, whatever you,
yes.
Whichever you prefer, for a New York Newsday. Now, you describe in your book how when you started writing gossip for the Post, your editor at the time wanted you to call Nora Ephron, who had just had her baby,
right,
and find out how much the baby weighed. And you didn't want to do it. You thought it was a real intrusive thing to do.
Well, I didn't want to call her. First of all, she wanted me to call and get some sort of comment or quote from Nora Ephron, like what the baby's name was. And I've run into this since then. And the way I handle it now that I'm the editor rather than the reporter or an assistant is, like, there's no need to call somebody that's in the hospital. We had a story on Harry Helmsley last year having some minor operation. And one of the people I was working with said, oh, he's at, whatever hospital it was, New York Hospital. Let's give him a buzz. I said, forget it. Call his office. There's no need to wake somebody up in a hospital bed. But my boss wanted me to call Nora Ephron up. So I sat there and didn't do it. And finally she forced me to do it. And Nora Ephron was very funny. In retrospect, at the time I was horrified, but she sort of picks up the phone. And there's this groggy, hello. And I said, hi, I'm calling from Page 6 of the Post. And we heard that you had a baby and we wanted to ask you about it. And there's like this very long pause. And she says, you guys must be pretty hard up for news. And I said, we just wondered what the baby's name was. She told me it was a boy and his name was Max, and she sounded really sick. And then she got off the phone, and my boss says to me, how much did the baby weigh? And I hadn't asked how much the baby weighed. I barely made the phone call. And she said, well, you'll have to call her back. And I faked it. I mean, I couldn't do it to the woman after I'd just woken her up and she sounded so sick. So I stuck my finger on the button on the phone and pretended that I called and made up some number, 6 pounds, 4 ounces, or whatever it was, because I didn't have the heart to call her back again. I mean, it's those kinds of things. These things are, gossip columns are supposed to be fun. They can be real informative, but there's no need for them it's not nuclear war you're writing about. You don't need a comment from the person involved in a situation like this. And I felt really bad about doing that to Nora Ephron, but...
Would you still have to do things that you feel bad about doing?
Yeah, occasionally, but I don't really... I'm trying to think of something that I may have felt bad about.
Yeah, tell
us
something you felt really bad about recently.
Oh, when people's... I always feel bad when you hear rumors about people's marriages breaking up. And even those kinds of stories, I only run them if they're practically in court. I mean, I'm not going to sit there and say, oh, there's a slight problem in such and such a marriage, because if you're not really sure about it and the marriage is not, like, officially breaking up, you may help to break it up if you start printing stuff like that. I had to call John Gutfreund, who's the head of Solomon Brothers here in New York, so these rumors that, he and his wife were breaking up. And that was a very uncomfortable phone call, because you're sort of sitting there like, we heard you were, you know, splitting up. I had to do the same thing with Hugh Carey, the former governor of New York, and his wife, Evangeline Gulaitis, and they have split up. But it was a very, very uncomfortable phone call, and I was cringing while I was asking the questions, you know. And you say to yourself, well, then why do you do those kind? I ask myself sometimes, why do you do those kinds of stories? And because they fit into this kind of a column. You know, I don't do that many of them, but I do them once in a while. But I'm very certain when I run it that they're really true, because you can just hurt people too much if they're not.
In the days of columnists like Hedda Hopper, gossip columnists could really make or break people's careers. They could ruin people if they wanted to, and I think they sometimes did. Do you think that gossip columnists still have that kind
no.
of power?
No, they really don't have that kind of power anymore. TV's really the medium now that can make or break people. That's why there are so many different kinds of celebrities, because TV can take somebody like, that little girl, Jessica McClure in Texas, I mean, that would always be a big human interest story. But she was, like, turned overnight into this huge celebrity. It's television. As soon as you put somebody's face on TV and splash it all over the country, they're an instant celebrity. Gossip columns don't have that kind of power anymore, although it's funny in what ways they do make an impact. There's an anecdote that I relate in the book about a gossip column. I mean, it appeared in page 6 about one of these, about Ortega of Nicaragua, which is sort of a weird person to be writing a gossip column about, but I've actually written a number of items about him, because when he comes to New York, he tends to dine at places like the Russian Tea Room, which I would find sort of strange for somebody like Ortega. But anyway, he was here with his wife, and we ran a short item on page 6 about them going to an optical store on, I think it was Madison Avenue, and spending some $3,500 on eyeglasses, designer eyeglasses, special bulletproof eyeglasses. And every place in New York, everybody in New York has a press agent, it seems to me, most of the time. They're always pushing them, their clients. And this item was planted by a press agent who represented the optical store. And I didn't really want to, you know, I hate to run that kind of stuff, but it was sort of an amusing item. So we run it, and the next thing I know, every time there's a reference to Ortega in the papers, it's, you know, the designer in, the dictator in designer glasses. I mean, and this went on and on. There was a huge interview in Playboy with him last year, and it was brought up again. And this eyeglass spree happened 3-4 years ago. I mean, it's very funny. And it was from the page 6 item that all this came up. But that's hardly making or breaking a career. It's just, it is amusing sometimes the way they can have an impact and how a small anecdote will be picked up and repeated over and over again. You know, I'll be at a cocktail party and somebody say, well, I was reading last week, and isn't that? I'm like, yeah, I wrote it. So it's people love little silly tidbits mm-hmm. of information.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot more people who are openly out, openly gay or lesbian than there were, say, mm-hmm. in the early days of the gossip columns.
Right.
Yet I think there's still this kind of unwritten law that you never bring someone out of the closet unless they want to come out themselves. And I was wondering if you observe that in your
Everybody
column.
Everybody does, I think, really. Because that's somebody's personal business. There was an instance a number of years ago, it was 5-6 years ago, of a guy in New York who was the former cultural affairs commissioner who, as a political statement at a public function, came out. And I forget what, I think it had something to do with the gay rights bill. He just announced that he was gay. And that was covered, and it actually appeared in page 6, an item about the event that it took place at. But he wanted to make a statement, and he came out. You don't do it for people. I don't think anybody does that.
How do you handle AIDS stories also? There's always stories circulating that such and such a star has AIDS.
I just don't run them. I got myself into a situation once. There were rumors running all around town about Richard Pryor. And it's just in this day and age, every time somebody starts to look gaunt, mm-hmm. the rumor mill starts churning. Oh, he must have AIDS, especially if it's someone who's kind of, you know, known to be gay. But Pryor was not. So I was sort of surprised at these rumors. And two other columns in New York printed the rumor. I dropped it because really I just didn't think it was true. I couldn't get any confirmation. And it was too damaging to print without confirmation. So I didn't run it. And after that, it turns out he did not. And at least one of the columns had to print a retraction. And I saw a television interview with him some months later. And he said his life was a living hell for a while after this piece appeared, because everyone thought he had AIDS. And he realized what it would be like to actually publicly admit you have AIDS. And people shunned him like he was a leper. And, you know, he had a really rough time. And so I just decided after that I would never, if somebody even called me up, because some people call me up and say, I hear so-and-so has AIDS, I don't even make a phone call on it. Because even if I confirmed it, I wouldn't run it. I think that that's also somebody else's business.
Mm-hmm.
If you know, the family of a person who has AIDS dies and they want to put it in the obituary, that's their business. So, I mean, I don't think gossip columns should play that sort of role.
When you decide that you don't want to run something because it violates your ethics, Do you ever get pressure either from editors to run it anyways, or do you feel pressured knowing that your competition's going to get it, even if you don't print it, so it's going to be public one way or another, you might as well go with it?
No, well, I see. There's a story actually today on page 6 of the New York Post about a very famous or a very wealthy Manhattan businessman who is having an affair with a young actress slash model. He doesn't mention the businessman's name, but he mentions the model slash actress's name and runs her picture. And I found that very interesting, and I'm sure everybody else that reads the column will too, but I wouldn't have run it.
Why not?
I don't know. I just think you're really treading on very uncertain ground there when you start getting into running who's having an affair with whom. He doesn't mention the businessman's name, which is sort of fascinating, but it's one of those things where people are going to start playing guessing games now, and I don't know. I wouldn't have run it, but I know a lot of people are going to be interested to read that item, and they're going to start trying to figure out. That's actually a sort of a semi-blind item, which very few columns run those anymore, when you run which famous producer was seen with which, you know, lovely showgirl at they used to run those all the time, but blind items have gone out of fashion, really. But I wouldn't have run that. I don't really get that much pressure, though, and my editors at the, particularly at Newsday, are pretty good about that. Nobody really forces stories down my throat.
Are Liz and Jackie still considered good copy? That is, Liz Taylor and Jackie Onassis.
Oh, Jackie, the best copy are people who don't want to be written about. If I could get a good Greta Garbo scoop, I'd run it in a minute. The people that are out there publicizing themselves and are real easy to write about, sure, you can do them once in a while, but it's no challenge. Even the movie stars who are not completely inaccessible, like the Woody Allens and the Robert Redfords, who, you know, they're available for press once in a while, they're much more fun to write about than somebody who's out there, you know, flacking themselves to death, because it is a little bit harder to get something on them. But Liz Taylor will always be fascinating because she's like the last of the movie legends. There's nobody else left like her.
Do you really care about her?
I find her a fascinating character because I think she's not one of those people that became a celebrity when they were in their 20s. Like, she grew up in the public eye. I think she's a really fascinating character. But do I really care, like, whether she gained 5 pounds? Do I really, really care?
Well, do you?
No, I really don't. I care more whether I gained 5 pounds. It's still fun, though. I mean, she was at a film festival once that I went to in France, and it was hysterical to watch people chase her around. You would think that the second coming had occurred. It was really entertaining. I feel kind of bad for her. I wouldn't want to be in her shoes, but it was pretty funny. Lise, Lise, oh, I love you. You know, all these crazy French people running around screaming and yelling at her. It was, I got a big kick out of it.
I want to talk with you more, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is Susan Mulcahy, and she's the author of a new memoir titled My Lips Are Sealed, Confessions of a Gossip Columnist. And she used to edit the Page 6 gossip column for the New York Post, and now edits a similar page in New York Newsday, which is called Inside New York. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about gossip with gossip columnist and editor Susan Mulcahy, author of the new book My Lips Are Sealed. Let's talk about how you get your stories. As you've said, you have your sources. Now, some of those sources are publicists.
Some of them,
right. What's the difference between a good and a bad publicist in the way they'll pitch a story to you?
Well, the bad publicist, and I hate to say this, 90% of the people in the profession fall into that category, are the ones that they don't know what kind of story you need, because a lot of the time they don't even read the columns. And this isn't, you know, this happens to every journalist. Somebody will call up and start pitching you a story and say, well, I mean, I have people call me with stories about, you know, sporting events and, you know, garden club listings. And I say, do you read the column? This is not the sort of thing that we run. But good publicists are the ones that know what you need and help you out with things that are unrelated often to the clients that they work with, so that when they do need a favor for a client, you're more willing to say, sure, let me see if I can fit in a story about that. Bad publicists, there's some of them, this guy calls me up and he's always pitching stories about what happened at various restaurants, and he'll call up and say, you know, Robert Redford came in last night and he had a linguine. I'm like, oh my God, stop the presses. Let me get the editors with this. We should get this on the front page. And he doesn't, I try to explain that, you know, there are a lot of celebrities in New York and they all go out to restaurants every night. And just the fact that somebody ate at a restaurant, it isn't a story. If something happened while they were there that's newsworthy, fine. But it, just the fact that somebody went out to dinner at a restaurant is not a story. And that's, I swear to God, that's half my calls are people calling up telling me that celebrities ate at restaurants.
Well, so in New York, don't all the restaurants and all the delicatessens...
They all have press agents.
They have their own press agents.
But certain people, if they have the right sense of humor, like I love to write about the New York delis because the press agents for the delis are so funny. There was a guy who's actually retired now who represented the Carnegie Deli and the Stage Deli and a number of others for quite a few years. And he would come up with the most... lame, unbelievable publicity stunts to get what he would refer to as a column mention thal. You know, he'd call him and say, we have heart-shaped matzo balls in the soup for Valentine's Day. What do you say, thal? Column mention? And it just, he was so funny. I couldn't resist, and I would run all these items. We finally had to stop it because he was coming up with the most absurd shaped matzo balls for every possible holiday. But he would do busts and chop liver of people, and I found them so entertaining that that's sort of a part of New York lore, the delis, the Carnegie Deli.
Well, you have a deli story from just a few days ago.
That's right. I love the matzo ball soup.
Oh, and also that Jackie Mason is on the outs.
Oh, yes, there's
the,
a big
the Carnegie
feud
deli.
Going on with the Carnegie Deli.
Right.
Big feud.
Now, you are an editor as well as a writer.
Right.
So it's really your responsibility to make sure that all the facts are accurate and that you're not going to get sued for libel.
Yeah, I have two terrific reporters that work with me, Karen Freifeld and Michael Fleming, and they work on their own stories or they follow through on tips that I assign them sometimes. And at the end of the day, I go over people's stories and edit the column and put it together.
Have you ever been sued?
Nope. I've received, people get annoyed, you know, and they might call and yell at me or send letters, but I've never actually had anybody file a lawsuit against me because I am pretty careful.
But when you're writing a story that's not planted by a publicist, but you've gotten a lead on something, and you're going to reveal this in your column, say something that the person would just as soon have kept private. It's not that the facts are wrong, they can't sue you for libel, but they would have preferred that it not be printed.
Well, yeah.
How do you feel about that, knowing that you're making private facts public?
Well, I've come to realize that a lot of the people that say that are really, they're not being 100% truthful. They try and tell you that it's going to ruin their lives if you print it, but a lot of the time it's not even that personal and they just don't want to print it. Sometimes I don't run stuff if people really mad. They say, look, this chain of events will occur if you run this and it's going to be really disastrous for me. I mean, I sort of have got a good detector for when people are being truthful and when they're just sort of trying to pull the wool over my eyes because they don't want a particular fact in the newspaper. You'd be surprised at the sort of things that people... I had a publicist once who represented Michael J. Fox. She got furious at me, and she said, you're always putting things in the paper that people, they just aren't ready to announce yet. And I said, well, those are called scoops. You know, that's the nature of the business. But most people don't. You know, most gossip columns do not stick their nose that far into people's business.
Any regrets about a story you went with that you wish you hadn't?
Many minor ones, but I can't think of any. I really can't think of any huge story that I ran that really hurt somebody that I'm sorry I ran. I mean, I once heard from after the '84 elections, I ran a story about some changes in John Glenn's presidential campaign staff, and apparently I found out about a year later that two people on the staff were fired after the item ran. They were accused of being the leaks for it, and I felt really bad about that because it wasn't that huge a story. If I'd known people were going to lose their jobs, I never would have run it. But nothing so awful that I really feel I damaged somebody's life, you know, irreparably.
Why do you love gossip? Do you love gossip?
I do like gossip. I really do. I used to, when I first started doing this, I kind of thought, should I admit to being a gossip columnist? Is this good for my reputation? But I don't think there is anybody who doesn't love gossip. And I like, it's fun to know about things as they're happening, or sometimes it seems like even before they happen. That's what half the fun of working at a newspaper and being in a newsroom and working at a gossip column is a part of that.
When you're going to a party and you're on duty, you're going especially to see what you can find out about the people who are there.
Right.
How do you go about doing it?
A lot of parties, if I cover a party and I'm writing about the party itself, I might literally take a notebook out and go around and get quotes from people. I've done that at the Swifty Lazar Oscar party, which I've covered a couple times in California. But if I'm just going there on the chance that something might happen, or maybe I'm trying to cultivate a few new sources, I make sure that I introduce myself to people when I'm talking to them, make sure they know that I write for a newspaper. Because if I'm standing there, I've been in situations where I overhear this unbelievable, people start talking to me and telling me this stuff that would make a great story, but if they have no idea who I am, it's really not very fair. So I say, oh, I write for a newspaper, you know, would you mind if I looked into that as an item? And sometimes they'll have a fit and say, oh my God, no, you can't do that. And other times they go, sure, just don't tell anybody who told you. In that case, you know, it works out fine. But I don't really cover that many parties sort of with my notebook out. Most of the time I'm there. Parties are I don't do that much party coverage. It's more as a way to cultivate new sources and meet new people than it is for actual party information. Although some of these, like the Swifty Lazar Oscar party is just unbelievably star-studded and is quite amazing. So I've written about that the times that I've been to it.
When a celebrity's at a party that you're at and they're drunk and make a fool of themselves, what do you do? Do you cover it or not?
No, I don't. I was at a party where I saw an actress, an older woman who apparently has a drinking problem, and she was completely smashed and she was making a fool out of herself. But I mean, it was like a very sorry spectacle. I didn't really think it was my place to cover it. I don't know, people who are listening to this program probably think, well, doesn't she write about anything good, like people getting drunk or cheating on their wives? And there's a way to do certain things. I wouldn't do it. I felt really bad for it. I didn't really think it was my place to cover it. I guess I could have, and maybe somebody else would have, but anyway,
okay.
I didn't.
So if you're not writing about that, what is your idea of the perfect story?
The perfect story.
Mm-hmm.
It has to have a big name in it. That's, you know, one of the ones that's tough to write about, a Greta Garbo or a Jackie Onassis. It has to have an element of humor in it, either in the writing or in the person doing something that's humorous. Maybe even something that's a little bit knocks them down to a human level. Like one of my favorite Donald Trump stories is the fact that everybody writes about what a huge bestseller his book was. Well, I like even better the fact when the book came out, Trump sort of enlisted the aid of several friends of his to buy up large lots of the book to kind of guarantee the fact that it was going to be on the bestseller list, showing that even Donald Trump is slightly insecure. I mean, that to me was a great story, because it really sort of, his ego is so inflated and so overblown and out of control that to sort of show that he was a little bit human too. That was a good story.
Okay, I want to thank you very much
for talking with
us. My guest has been Susan Mulcahy, and she writes about gossip. She edits the Inside New York page in New York Newsday, used to edit the infamous Page 6 column in the New York Post, and she's written a new memoir titled My Lips Are Sealed, Confessions of a Gossip Columnist. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.